Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio, your intelligence briefing in this, the war for the free world. I'm Kyle Scheidler, filling in for your host, Frank Gaffney. Joining me now is a man well known to the program. He's a senior vice president for policy and programs at Center for Security Policy and formerly the chief of staff for Ambassador John Bolton at the U.S. State Department. He is Fred Flights. Fred, thank you for joining us.
Hey, Kyle. Good to be here.
Fred, I wanted to talk to you about that recent missile launch by the North Koreans on November 28th. They launched a ballistic missile believed to have possibly the longest range of any missile they've tested thus far. What does that mean in terms of the North Korean program and the threat that it poses?
Well, it was a significant development for a number of reasons. Now, North Korea tested two missiles last July that were ICBMs, and they were fired straight up in the air, one of which had a range that, if it was fired on a normal trajectory, may have been able to hit the U.S. Midwest. This recent missile, which was launched about a week ago, had an estimated range on a normal trajectory of hitting the entire United States, possibly as far as Florida. So its range was extraordinary. Second, it appeared to be much more sophisticated. Earlier, North Korean sophisticated rockets had something called steering rockets to steer in the engine, to steer the rocket. This missile had a gimbaled engine, which means it had a rocket that would actually swivel to change its trajectory. This is a much more sophisticated design that is what the U.S. and all advanced nations that have missiles have. It's a significant technological leap, and it raises major questions about the threat that North Korea's missiles pose to the United States and whether North Korea is getting some pretty heavy-duty help from, I think, Russia or China to advance its missile program.
You know, Fred, I think one of the things that struck me was the reaction to this most recent test from those on the left, and I'm thinking particularly of a New York Times piece, as well as some recent statements by Hillary Clinton, both of which seem to focus on this idea that sanctions and diplomacy are our only option, they're the only thing that can fix this. And I have to wonder, given the advancement of the North Korean program, isn't it possible that we're running out of time for sanctions and diplomacy to work?
I think that's a good point. And let me mention, not only did Hillary Clinton call for sanctions, she also said during a trip to China, which I might add, she criticized Trump foreign policy at a time that we're all worried about the Logan Act and people interfering with presidential national security decision making. She said in her trip to China that taking no action is also an option. Now, you and I know that taking no action during the Obama administration, during their using their abysmal policy called strategic patience, which was a policy to do nothing, it's why the North Korean nuclear missile programs grew at such an astounding rate during the Obama years. Now, this idea that we can simply sit back and negotiate, basically what the New York Times, the left, is saying, let's buy the North Koreans off again. Now, the problem with that is that I think we have to face the reality that a nuclear program with an estimated 60 nuclear weapons, which is what the U.S. intelligence community has, ICBMs, solid-fueled missiles that can be fired very, very quickly, cruise missiles and submarine launch missiles, a nation with an arsenal like this is not simply preparing it as a deterrent. This is an offensive force that I fear North Korea one day will use to forcibly unite the Korean Peninsula under its leadership and to drive the United States from the Asia-Pacific region.
So if we're running out of time, for all the reasons that we mentioned, do we have any other options?
Well, I recently wrote in a piece in The Hill that I think it is time for the president to start considering the limited use of military force, possibly shooting down North Korean missiles, a naval blockade, maybe stopping and searching North Korean ships at sea, declaring North Korea a missile flight zone. The reason is I think we have to back up our words with action and make it clear to North Korea that we're not going to simply stand by and allow these nuclear missile programs to progress. I think we have to do this carefully. There's a risk of North Korean retaliation, but my fear is they're going to use these weapons eventually anyway. I think it's crucial that the U.S. take the initiative, stop this nuclear program by force if necessary, then we can talk.
Well, I think there's limits to where the North Koreans can escalate. If we escalate to sort of searching, shipping, as you mentioned, maybe shooting down the rockets that they launch, there's limits to where the North Koreans can escalate because they've already gone so far as it is.
I think that's right. I mean, some people fear that, look, if we start shooting down North Korean missiles, they're going to fire North Koreans and South Korea. If they did that, it would be suicide because we would flatten the country. Would they fire missiles at American ships? Would they fire at South Korean ships? They did attack a South Korean ship just a few years ago. We don't know the answer to that yet, but I believe the North Koreans respect strength. They certainly didn't respect the Obama administration, which is why it's funny that there's many on the left who are saying that Trump's belligerence is causing North Korea to conduct all these missile tests. Well, you and I know how silly that is because these missile tests expanded during the Obama administration, a president who could not have been weaker. So I think it's clear we make it that the president send a message to Pyongyang that there's a new sheriff in town and we're not going to stand by while these programs that could be used against the United States homeland continue to be developed.
I think that's a really good point, Fred. I wanted to get your take also on a recent report that I saw from Bloomberg News that said that Germany is apparently interested in getting involved in the North Korean negotiations, sort of flouting their success in unifying East and West Germany as a reason that they have some expertise in this area. And it led me to wondering, Fred, who in the international community is helpful in this space and who is meddling? Who are the allies that we can rely on to be useful, and who's really sticking their nose where it doesn't belong?
This is a good question. Germany and the European Union have long wanted to get involved in the North Korean nuclear negotiations, and the U.S. has said no. I say we keep them out. Frankly, all the Europeans are going to do is to push for accommodation and appeasement of the North Koreans, just like they're doing right now with Iran. It's a bad idea, and I'm certain that President Trump isn't going to agree to this.
Well, I certainly hope so. You mentioned Iran, so Fred, I wanted to get your take on discussions regarding Iran and North Korean cooperation. What do you think is the state of that cooperation, and how does it influence how we address the North Korean crisis?
I think it's fairly certain that there's strong cooperation. And what I've been contemplating recently is how did North Korea advance its missile program so fast? And there are many people speculating that North Korea received assistance from the Russians and the Chinese. I think we have to look at the real possibility that Iran is financing and helping North Korea find missile scientists to come to North Korea to develop missiles that will benefit Iran and North Korea. And I suspect that much of the funding for this effort is coming from the 2015 nuclear deal, which, you know, North Korea, Iran received over $1 billion in sanctions relief. Their military budget went up by several fold after this agreement. I think this is all a consequence of the naive nuclear diplomacy by the Obama administration with Iran.
Well, Fred, I appreciate your insight into this tricky matter. I know all Americans are watching it very closely and are very concerned. Fred Flights, always a pleasure. Thank you very much. Coming up next here on Secure Freedom Radio, we'll be joined by Liz Yore. Liz is a child's rights attorney and the head of End FGM Today, where she specializes in dealing with the threat of female genital mutilation affecting as many as 500,000 Americans and American immigrants. So we're looking forward to having her joining us in just a little bit. I am Kyle Scheidler, filling in for Frank Gaffney here on Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is your guest host, Kyle Scheidler. I am filling in for the inestimable Frank Gaffney, who is off today. Joining me now is Liz Yohr. She's an attorney and international child's rights advocate specializing in female genital mutilation. She is the head of End FGM Today. Liz, thank you for joining Secure Freedom Radio.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me, Kyle.
Liz, I know you've been following this interesting case in Detroit of a Detroit-area doctor who's been accused of mutilating the genitals of over 100 little girls and is currently facing federal charges. Let us know where that case stands right now.
Right now, today, there is a hearing in court. The hearing in court is to a request by the defense to throw out, dismiss the charge of crossing state lines for the purpose of perpetrating a criminal sexual assault on two little girls. The prosecution has alleged in court that there possibly are over 100 victims, but in this case, there are presently four victims of this doctor's practice of FGM. Today, the court is going to hear arguments. There's already been pleadings filed. The prosecution alleges that there is certainly enough evidence that the doctor is involved in a conspiracy with others to lure and bring children into the state of Michigan, crossing state lines, to have FGM perpetrated on them, female genital mutilation. The defense that the government has to prove and has not even proved in its initial filings that the defendant, Dr. Nagawala, a female doctor, was sexually gratified as a result of this sexual assault. The sexual gratification is an ingredient requirement of the actual law. The prosecution argues that it is not. Now, you know, if you were to believe the defense or take the defense argument, there would be imposed on both the victim and the government an additional requirement that there was some form of sexual gratification as a result of not only the injury and the assault, but an affirmative duty to show that the perpetrator was sexually gratified by his act.
Liz, that's very troubling that the defense is essentially arguing that because the doctor in this case didn't receive sexual gratification for engaging in female genital mutilation, that somehow the federal law doesn't apply.
Correct. And the impact of this argument, Kyle, would be that both in state and federal laws, because we know every state has very extensive criminal sexual abuse laws on behalf of adults and victims, that would, you know, hugely turn the whole law on its head and impose this onerous burden. My concern most especially is on the victim, that the victim would have to provide evidence of that. So that was never envisioned in any both state or federal law. If you look at the legislation, the legislative history of the law, it's not required. All that's required is that you prove that a victim is humiliated or degraded. And, you know, Kyle, and one of the interesting things is that the defense is trying to impose a new standard, a new burden of proof on the part of the prosecution and the victim, quite frankly. And we know that victims are traumatized, not only physically and emotionally burdened, but this is a huge shame that takes oftentimes years to disclose. So that's the nature of the argument in court today to throw out the major charge, count six, of the superseding indictment. So there's a lot happening in the state of Michigan. Michigan has seen firsthand the impact of this brutal procedure that's been outlawed in the United States since 1996.
Female genital mutilation is a practice that there's the weight of almost the entire community comes down on these girls, both from their parents, but also from their religious leaders and from other members of their community. So it's a real struggle, and it's disturbing that there are people out there trying to add even more burdens on these victims. I understand there's also some movement at the federal level on FGM legislation. Is that true? What's going on there?
Yes. Interestingly, U.S. Representative Dave Trott, who is from Michigan, is sponsored legislation that sailed through unanimously the Judiciary Committee. This legislation increases the criminal penalties for female genital mutilation under the federal law from 5 to 15 years. That's up for a vote today on the House floor. We're confident that it's going to sail through not only the House but also the Senate. So there's additional work being done to recognize that this growing brutal practice. The CDC, Kyle, has said that over 500,000 women and girls are at risk in the United States. So we need to send a loud and clear message to the communities that are practicing this, that it is criminal, that the criminal charges are going to be strengthened. It sends a loud message that the values in our country are such that are going to be backed up and supported by criminal legislation.
I think that's a really good point. And, you know, one of the things that strikes me is that in this Detroit case, it doesn't seem like it's necessarily being treated like the criminal conspiracy that it essentially is. I mean, the argument is that people were engaging this woman to conduct FGM from around the country, and yet she's been allowed essentially an unsecured bond and a lot of other things that no other person accused of these kinds of charges in a non-FGM case, she's gotten benefits that they wouldn't have gotten.
Well, that's right. And I don't know, whether it's the nature of the fact that she has a medical degree. I think that heightens the concern as far as I'm concerned. This is a defendant who was on when she was arrested, was on a plane to Kenya. So we have great concern. All of us are watching this trial, and we need to be sure that the victim's voice, that's the children, the unsuspecting little girls that had no idea that this was going to be happening to them, are given the full benefit of the federal government, of the law, and of the protection of society in the United States, that this procedure, this barbaric procedure, is not going to be tolerated.
Well, Liz, we're so glad that you're out there keeping an eye on this. She's an attorney and international child's rights advocate specializing in female genital mutilation. She is the head of End FGM Today. Well, Liz, thank you so much. I am Kyle Scheidler, filling in for Frank Gaffney here on Secure Freedom Radio.
more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm your guest host, Kyle Scheidler. I'm filling in for Frank Gaffney, who is off today. Joining me now, he's the Senior Vice President for Government Affairs at the Center for Security Policy, a founding editorial board member of the NATO Defensive Communications Journal, and has a long history reporting on and covering the issues in Latin America going all the way back to the 1980s and the civil wars down there. He's a good friend of mine, Mike Waller. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, Kyle.
Mike, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what's going on in Latin America right now. It's an area of the world I think we've taken our eye off the ball a little bit. But recently we had Senators Rubio and Cruz make a bit of a statement opposing Trump's choice for ambassador to Colombia. That seems like an odd thing for fellow Republicans to do. What's going on?
Well, Trump and Secretary of State Tillerson have completely ignored the region, even as the president restates his commitment to build a wall on our border with Mexico. And because they've been neglecting the region, they've been allowing Obama holdovers to have the run of the place and are simply reshuffling Obama holdovers around the Trump administration, keeping them in positions of authority and making the president's policy.
Well, that seems highly problematic. Now, this guy in question, Joseph McManus, can you tell us anything about him?
Well, he's a career diplomat. He's one of the Hillary Clinton cabal, as are most of the diplomats who are being shuffled around running our Latin America policy. But the big controversial thing about him is, and the senator's objection to him is, one of their objections, is that he was involved in the whole Benghazi affair and cover up, as have been some of these other diplomats who've been through the Foreign Service together most of their lives. So whenever you have a diplomat like that, you're not going to put him in an important post like Colombia, which is really the one place in Latin America where the U.S. has focused its resources and its policy to fight the narcotics wars.
And they're actually a NATO partner of ours, aren't they?
Yeah, they're participating with us in NATO things, and they've got some great relations with many of our NATO allies.
You know, I mean, this is such a crucial period in time for Latin America. We have the situation in Venezuela, where that regime is really crumbling, and nobody understands which way it's going to topple when it finally does. And to have State Department officials sort of from the old regime, so to speak, running the same old policies, and these are policies of engagement with socialists and dictatorships, including, of course, the Castro brothers in Cuba. It has to be at odds with the sort of America first, make America great again policy that President Trump has said that he wants to institute.
Right. It's completely at odds with make the America first policy. What is happening in Venezuela, of course, is you had a Marxist populist dictator, Hugo Chavez, take power and use Venezuela's vast oil wealth. It's a very wealthy country, although you wouldn't know it today, to fund revolutionary movements around the hemisphere and to bring in extremists like terrorists like Hezbollah and others and build relations with the Iranian government and give the Iranian government a foothold in our hemisphere. That regime has been collapsing since Hugo Chavez died, simply because it spent itself out of existence. And now, for the first time since Europeans settled Venezuela, you have a terrible refugee crisis and people fleeing for refuge overland to Colombia, but also people fleeing to the United States. So the problems are getting worse and worse. And you've got a Cuban security team there, loyal to Raul Castro, keeping the regime in power. And of course, the very people who ran U.S. policy under Obama to help it get this way are the ones who are running it for Donald Trump.
It's curious because, you know, Donald Trump made his statement at the UN where he lambasted Venezuela's failed socialist policies. He clearly has a vision of the region, but he doesn't have his eye, as I said earlier, on the ball down there. And of course, it's given these sort of socialist dictatorships like Venezuela and Cuba a lot of room to maneuver. Do we have partners down there we could be working with?
Sure. Venezuelan people, that would be a good place to start. The Colombian government would be a great place to start. In Guatemala,
That would be a great place to start. Think of Guatemala. I mean, if you think of it at all, it's a little country, but if you look at it on the map, it's most of Mexico's southern border. Guatemala is the interdiction point for nearly all of South American and Central American illegal immigrants coming up to the United States. They have to travel through Guatemala. And I've been down to the border area down on the Mexican-Guatemalan border, and it's very easy to choke off. The current government of Guatemala is friendly to the United States, President Jimmy Morales, yet the Obama administration had been trying to overthrow President Morales, and the Trump administration has kept the same Obama people in charge of that policy, and they're still trying to overthrow him. So we're destabilizing the Guatemalan government. We're destabilizing the Guatemalan economy. There's a billion-dollar silver mine, brand-new state-of-the-art silver mine, run by a Nevada-based company that the Obama and Trump ambassador to Guatemala has been working with Soros groups to shut down. Well, that's destabilizing to Guatemala's economy. The real scandal is, okay, that was Obama then, but the real scandal is that the ambassador who was in charge of doing that, his name is Todd Robinson, is now being considered by the Trump administration to run the U.S. embassy in Venezuela.
So from the frying pan into the fire, so to speak, even more opportunity to cause trouble.
Absolutely, absolutely. And he was working, Ambassador Robinson was working with Soros-funded radical NGOs that had supported Cuba and Castro. And in fact, they were tied to former communist insurgents. He had been working with them to put pressure to shut down this American and Canadian-owned silver mine, throwing thousands of Guatemalans out of work, costing investors, American investors, $1 billion, and at the same time, working Guatemala's sort of odd political system by forcing the Guatemalan Congress to name radical lawyers as the justices of the country's high court. So it's a judicial coup d'etat that he has been doing with the Soros people. This is Ambassador Todd Robinson. And Tillerson and Trump, possibly, may even reward this guy by naming him as our special chief of our embassy in Venezuela.
It's just remarkable when you know, Mike, to hear you describe it. It's this sort of slow motion coup d'etat, as you said, but not against our enemies, but against our friends. And this was a policy that we saw in the Obama administration time and time again, which was destabilizing our friends and rewarding our enemies. But I don't think any of us expected it to continue under President Trump. How do we draw this to his attention so that he can do something about it?
Well, it has been drawn to his attention, but it needs to be really drawn to his attention in an unpleasant way. We've tried to in a sort of a polite, supportive way. It centers around his own national security advisor, H.R. McMaster. Now, McMaster fired the pro-Trump people from the National Security Council. He fired almost all of them. And he put in their places people who not only were, say, never Trumpers, but holdovers from Barack Obama, who are now the implementers of Trump policies around the world. So that's why a lot of things you see are not happening the way the president said he wanted them to happen, because he entrusted H.R. McMaster to hire the right people on the NSC staff. These people are working straight out of the White House complex. The guy in charge of Western Hemisphere policy for Latin America, his name's Fernando Coutts. He was Barack Obama's Latin America chief on the National Security staff. He was a direct hire by Ben Rhodes, the political hack who was the number two on the Obama National Security Council. And his credentials are that he got his master's degree from the Clinton School at the Clinton Library.
Well, I got to tell you, Mike, this does not sound like drain the swamp to me. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. I want to thank you, Mike, for coming on. That was Mike Waller, Government Affairs Vice President for the Center for Security Policy and Latin America expert. Mike, thank you very much. I am Kyle Scheidler, filling in for Frank Gaffney here on Secure Freedom Radio.
Go go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm your guest host, Kyle Scheidler, filling in for Frank Gaffney, who is off. Joining me now is Maria Espinoza. She's the National Director of the Remembrance Project, which honors and remembers Americans and legal residents who have been killed by illegal aliens. And we thought Maria was the perfect person to speak to in the aftermath of the Steinle verdict in San Francisco. So, Maria, thank you very much for joining us here on Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me, Kyle.
It's our pleasure. Maria, quickly, just give me your initial reaction to the verdict. How did you react when you heard what happened?
Terribly disappointed, and my heart went out for the entire Steinle family and also to our Stolen Lives families who have suffered the same pain, because in a way they were re-victimized and were very saddened for the Steinles as well.
Of course, you have a large network of people who have suffered similar problems. I'm sure it must have brought back some bad memories.
Yes, it does for them. And, you know, just it really is a awakening, I guess, for the general public to understand that this is what's taking place all over the country. And this case is certainly more nationalized, I guess, than any other case that I know of. But yes, Cal, it's a big problem. It exposes the extent that the personal liberal agenda of some people, how far that will go.
I wanted to ask you about that and whether you felt that the political implications of this case really impacted the jury in their decision-making. I mean, do you feel like this is, in a sense, a case of jury nullification where the jury wanted to make a statement in defense of sanctuary cities?
Absolutely. Let's take a look at what's taking place. They're politicizing these people with liberal agendas, are politicizing innocent Americans, innocent American lives here. They're willing to take their personal agenda, whether it's lawful or not, all the way down to the mat, where they will release an illegal alien, five-time deportee, seven-time felony convictions, and this poor girl, Kate, who died in her father's arms, innocently walking along Pier 14, enjoying the day with her father, is no longer here with her family. And it's a terrible miscarriage of justice. And I certainly hope that the Justice Department uses its full force of the law in jailing this individual, because according to the U.S. Attorney's Criminal Manual, if a convicted felon, after being deported, Kyle, reoffends, he can get up to 10 years per felony conviction. If I'm reading that correctly, this man will hopefully be in jail for 70 years.
So maybe at least some element of justice there. Do you have much confidence in the Trump administration Justice Department that they're going to move forward and really make an object lesson in this case about the law?
I do have confidence in the Trump administration, and they have issued, I believe, a warrant for this individual. And I haven't read it, but I understand it's out there. So I think the justice hopefully will be served. We'll wait to find that out, what takes place there. But again, I think it's a wake-up call to all of your listeners to remain engaged and do even more if that's possible, if you have the time. And for instance, people can place their elected officials' phone numbers in their cell phones, in their speed dial, and call them whenever you see an injustice and demand that current laws are enforced and that you do want our borders secured. We want that wall built. And we want Americans placed first and foremost in everything that they do and how they legislate. And that right now, Kyle, is not taking place.
Well, I think you raise a really good point in the sense that, you know, if Capitol Hill and Washington doesn't hear from grassroots on this issue, then there's not going to be action. Do you have any specific policy recommendations that you want to see the Trump administration put into place as it relates to illegal aliens?
How about enforcing existing laws? That's, we've been battling that forever. I don't want the Congress drafting and trying to decide whether or not to pass new legislation to make it tougher for illegal aliens to be here, or make it tougher on if they recross. You know, we just want them to enforce the current laws. And I think that the elected officials on every level of government, your mayors, take a look at what the mayors are doing, some mayors are doing across the nation, you know, Chicago, New York, LA.
Yeah, that's a really good point, that especially as it relates to this issue, because of the sanctuary city policies of so many cities and counties and states in some cases, it really is not just a national issue, but it is also a local issue and a state issue.
So that's where we're strongest, in the local level. You know, you see some police departments who are supporting President Trump and have on their own are going to enforce reinstate the 287G program that was so successful, where, you know, Obama removed it.
Talk to me about that program. What is that program?
Well, that program is basically where there will be trained agents or police officers, you know, within the agencies, within local law enforcement, so that they can better facilitate when an illegal alien, a perpetrator, is jailed, arrested, actually. And that way the information gets to ICE right away, and they can place a detainer hold, requesting the department to hold this individual because he needs to be deported. He's illegally in the country. Now, you know, what we have are some offices pointing to one another saying, well, we have them here. We told them, they didn't come. Well, the other, you know, other people say, well, we asked them to hold them and they weren't held. So they released him. So it's a better communication with the 287G program. And it also, you know, they do not jail or deport the witnesses when they come forward as well. So that's a complete, you know, false narrative that's out there by the left, because they don't want any enforcement. And that's the problem here. You know, they're using the so-called dreamers, and they gave the illegal alien youngsters the word dreamer. And then now they have the DACA children, you know, which we all know now they're up to 30 years old. You know, those aren't children, but, you know, they're pulling on the heartstrings of Americans and hoping that we stand down on enforcing laws. So the 287G program was successful, and some of the law enforcement departments are reinstating that on their own. And President Trump's administration will train them. So we're, and again, they're the obstructionists, like those mayors, don't want laws enforced. And not only that, they took it a step farther where they have created slush funds for illegal aliens. They took taxpayer dollars and are defending illegal aliens in order to remain in the country.
Outrageous. Maria, we thank you so much for addressing this issue and keeping, you know, the victims first and foremost in our minds. That's all the time we have here today on Secure Freedom Radio. I've been your guest host, Kyle Scheidler, filling in for Frank Gaffney, who will be back tomorrow. Thank you, and tune in again next time.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.